reduced to ashes today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Thousands flee wildfires in California. Ellen Vandenberg was stuck with her baby in traffic, wondering if they'd make it out alive.
At one point I thought, should I be pouring water on my son? Like, are we going to die in our car?
And later, a U.S. Navy veteran recalls a day when he was 8 and going to school in Iran, a day that later inspired him to enlist.
These religious police soldiers stormed into the school, took all the flags, and the American flag in particular, set them on fire, and demanded that the kids who were there chant Maragbar Amrika, which is death to America, and stomp on the burning flag.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you along this Veterans Day holiday. Lots to get to today, so let's start with a story right here in the U.S. that's caught the attention of much of the world, the massive wildfires in California. Pictures of the devastated town of Paradise were on all the foreign news websites I checked this weekend. You probably saw those same pictures in your news feed, burned-out cars lining the roads in Paradise, California, in the same spots where residents abandoned them as they rushed to escape the flames.
It's blackout conditions.
Any units at the River Hospital, we've got 4 people trapped in the basement.
That's what the chaos and traffic jam sounded like on a police scanner.
North of you, I'm going to try and get there on foot. We've got both sides of the road engulfed.
Many people did not make it out. One resident who did is Ellen Vandenberg. She told the CBC's As It Happens what it was like fleeing her home in Paradise as the fire approached.
So I jumped in the car. The sky was starting to get dark, so it was starting to look like evening. And as soon as I turned onto my street out of my little side street, I was stuck in traffic. Both sides of the road going in one direction, people kind of just trying to vie for a position to try to get on the main road, the skyway that heads all the way down out of town, and we weren't moving anywhere. And I was probably in that same spot for about an hour, almost an hour. And so that was a really difficult part for me because I couldn't leave, and then I started seeing black billowing smoke, not just, you know, smoke drifting over, but just active smoke. I didn't see flames at that point yet, but I knew there was another fire because the main fire was behind me, and I was looking straight ahead, and so I knew there was another fire in the other canyon, and I just was trapped there. It was terrifying, and looking at other people in the cars, and everyone is scared, and there was one man who kept getting out of his truck and pacing through all the cars, and I rolled down my window. I said, what's going on? And he said, I have no idea. He said, but it's coming behind us. It's coming up on us, you know, and I knew he was right. And he looked terrified. And, you know, there were a lot of old people. It's kind of an older community. And it was terrifying.
One reason the experience was especially terrifying for Vandenberg, her baby was in the car with her. And she told the CBC the 5-month-old started the trip strapped into his car seat as usual.
I was stuck in the traffic, right? And it was getting really dark out, and I was, you know, he had woken up, and so I just got out. I mean, the car was in park often, and I even turned the car off sometimes because I wanted to conserve gas. I didn't know how long I'd be in the car. So I put the car in park, got him out of his car seat, brought him to the front seat. You know, I breastfeed, so I breastfed him. I changed his diaper on my lap, and then I just held him on my lap for the rest of the way because I actually thought that I was going to have to get out and run. And so I have a carrier that I can carry him on the front of me. And I just thought I might just get out of the car, grab the carrier, grab the dog, and just go and run. I mean, that was at one point I did think that because it was so, we were so locked in. It was gridlock. And then the cell service went out. And so because I kept calling my husband and saying, okay, I've moved a couple of, you know, streets further. Now I'm across from the Walgreens, or now I'm at this intersection, you know, barely creeping along, and then the cell service went out. And that's sort of when it got bad for me because I didn't have anyone to talk to. I took a couple of videos of myself just to kind of have somebody to talk to and just tell my loved ones that I love them. And I thought, this is ridiculous. My phone's going to burn up. Why would, like, how am I can't send this video. And at one point I thought, should I be pouring water on my son? Like, what, how, like, are we going to die in our car? You know, I don't know if people did. I I would imagine that a lot of people died in their vehicles or trying to run out of their vehicles. I can't imagine everyone having gotten out. I hope that everyone did. I don't know.
Wow. Ellen Vandenberg speaking there to the Canada CBC. Her home in Paradise, California is now gone. She and her family are safe and staying with relatives. We wanted to get to some of the science that helps explain what is happening in California right now. So we called up Glenn McDonald at UCLA. Before we talk science, I asked him how he and his family are coping. They had to evacuate their home in Malibu because of the fire danger there.
We're fine and we're back home. But there are homes in the vicinity quite close that are just completely down to the foundation now. You know, we experience wildfires here in the state annually. I mean, it's a part of the California environment. But when you're actually evacuated, when the major highways north and south that allow you to get in or out of your community are completely shut down by the fire, and where everything is under that smoky pall, it's a different experience. It's no longer theoretical. You're living it.
So there are several fires in California as we speak, but these two, one near L.A., another north of Sacramento, they're said to be among the worst in the state's history. But just the latest in what seems to be now an almost unending series of terrible fires in California in the last few years. The president has blamed bad forest management. Others blame development patterns. California Governor Jerry Brown and a lot of scientists, including you, are convinced that a big part of what's going on there is due to climate change. Can you explain the connection?
Sure, absolutely. If we just look at climate change, the 21st century has really been, in a sense, literally off the charts in terms of our temperatures. What we're getting is we're getting an earlier spring, we're getting a hotter summer, we're getting a longer fall. In Southern California, we have a fire season that runs throughout the year now. Because of those high temperatures, and because we've also had a deficit in precipitation over most of the 21st century, we have fuels that are extremely, extremely dry earlier in the fire season. By the time we get our major winds, these fuels are absolutely, absolutely explosively dry. And then, of course, if fires break out during very high temperatures, they are much, much more ferocious and difficult to fight.
Is this also a global trend, like climate change increasing the number and intensity of wildfires around the world?
Oh, there's no question about it, that particularly in semi-arid regions like California, the Mediterranean basin, for example, Australia, you could be seeing this story played out in Australia, South Africa. This is not a local story. This is a story that we can broadcast to really to these semi-arid regions around the world.
Yeah, so given what we now know about how climate change is affecting California and other places, what should we be doing differently going forward?
Look, obviously, if we can mitigate the release of CO2 and other greenhouse gases, that's going to help. But we're not going to dodge that bullet right now. So we really have to look at our building materials and our landscaping. You know, California has moved, and particularly in some jurisdictions, looking at, you know, not using wood shingle roofs, for example. In my own town, that's absolutely, you have to have a inflammable roofing and things like that. I think there are things we can do to fire-harden structures. I think we have to look at what we plant. Palm trees, for example, they can be extremely flammable. Then they kind of serve as Roman torches where they're spreading these burning fronds into your neighbor's home and things like that. So our plantings we'll have to look at.
You know, some of the things that you mentioned sound expensive. Some of them sound like they're going to take years. How much longer till it's no longer safe or wise to live in California, do you think?
Well, I mean, look, I think almost any jurisdiction in the world has a certain degree of natural hazards. If we were in eastern United States, you have ice storms, right, which bring down power infrastructure, which cause automobile accidents. Central parts of the continent, we have tornadoes. We go to Florida, you have hurricanes. We're part of nature. We live into this matrix. We're never going to completely control it. But what we can do then is by using smart practices, we can try to limit some of our vulnerability and increase our resilience to these things. I don't think people are going to move out of California any more than they're going to vacate the continent of Australia, Southern Africa, or the Mediterranean basin.
I know you said you're back at home, but neighbors not too far away from you lost their houses. Are you in the clear?
Yeah, right now it looks like we're in pretty good shape. Maybe not quite so good for folks down along the coast in parts of Malibu.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed for you and wishing everybody in California all the best. Glenn, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Glenn McDonald, who holds the John Muir Memorial Chair in Geography at UCLA. He's also the former director of UCLA's Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. As you heard earlier, he and his family had to evacuate their home in Malibu. Aaron Baker knows Malibu well. Her father lives there. Aaron is Time Magazine's Africa Bureau Chief based in Cape Town, South Africa. She was thousands of miles away on a beach when she learned that her father's hometown was being evacuated.
I called my dad immediately, and he was in the middle of packing up the car. He couldn't talk. And then a few hours later, his wife, my stepmom, sent a photo that a neighbor had been taken at the beginning of the fire. And at that point, we knew that the house wasn't going to last.
You posted a photo that was taken by an AP photographer on the scene. It shows your father's home consumed by flames. Can you tell me about that home? Did you grow up there?
I know I didn't grow up there, but every time I go home and I see him, I stay there. In fact, one of the notes that my stepmom sent when she sent the photo was like, that used to be your room. My wedding dress was actually hanging in the closet. And I kept it at my dad's house because I didn't need it in South Africa. So I have lots of memories there, lots and lots of memories.
Yeah. So what made you decide to post that picture and share your thoughts about it?
Well, it's funny. I'm a correspondent. I covered conflict around the world, and it's always been a little distant. Oftentimes, like if I'm in Afghanistan or something and there's a suicide bomb, my mom would call me being like, are you okay? And it would always be a question of, well, mom, it's a big town, like it's a big country, I'm fine. But this time there was a news story and it literally was home.
So I know everybody's at your mother's house in the San Fernando Valley. Is everybody doing okay?
Look, it's rough. You know, my dad is doing the dad thing, which is calling the insurance company, figuring out the next steps. I think it's pretty rough on my stepmom. But she did tell me, she just sent me a little note saying that she went shopping yesterday. And when people heard why she was shopping for your basic pajamas, underpants, that sort of thing, people were giving her deep discounts and gifts and being really supportive. Wow. So that made me feel better. It made me feel that people are caring about them, even though I'm so far away from them.
Aaron Baker, Time Magazine's Africa Bureau Chief, speaking with us from Cape Town. Thanks very much. All the best.
Thank you, Marco.
The smoke clouds hanging over California right now are ominous. And I got to say, reminded me of a suggestion I got from one of you for some music we should play on the show to match the mood of these times we're living right now.
آهای خبردار مستی
Sina Bagheri listens to us on WGBH right here in Boston. His request, Iranian singer Homayoun Shajarian and the song Ahai Habardar. In Farsi, that means, more or less, hey, listen up. Sina told us that the day he wrote us, he was feeling cloudy, a bit sad maybe, but not angry sad. The song is simply about someone who is asking the sadness to stop choking him, wrote Sina, but at the same time, you don't hear any hope in his voice. Sina says it sounds like the singer had already given up on hope. A lot of times, continued Sina, that's my exact feeling when thinking about better days for Iran and how people have been fighting for centuries, but it seems like you never get there and things just keep getting worse. Thank you, Sina Bagheri, for your Monday mood music request. What is your mood, and what's a song to match it? Or maybe you found a song for some attitude adjustment. Either way, tell us, tell me on Twitter. We're at PRI The World. I'm at Marco Werman. The request line is open. This is The World. Among several remarkable World War I commemorations over the weekend in Europe, this one stood out.
Monsieur Emmanuel Macron, président de la République française, et Madame Angela Merkel, chancelière de la République fédérale d'Allemagne.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron met in Compiègne, France, at the spot where Germany signed the armistice that ended World War I 100 years ago. Merkel and Macron appeared to be visibly moved after unveiling a plaque there. At one point, they held hands and smiled at each other. It almost looked like they had lived through the Great War themselves. If there is concern about who will remember the past when those who actually lived it are no longer around, that scene helped temper that. Of course, President Trump was also in France this weekend. Here he is speaking at an American cemetery outside Paris.
The American and French patriots of World War I embody the timeless virtues of our two republics: honor and courage, strength and valor, love and loyalty, grace and glory. It is our duty to preserve the civilization they defended and to protect the peace they so nobly gave their lives to secure one century ago.
But Trump was noticeably absent during at least one key ceremony this weekend, and at times a message from Macron, the host, was hard to hear as anything but a direct rebuke to the politics of Donald Trump.
Ne retranchons rien de ce qu'il y avait de pureté, d'idéal, de principe supérieur.
Macron spoke about the patriotism of our elders. Patriotism is the exact opposite of nationalism, he said. Nationalism, of course, is a term that Trump has recently embraced to describe his own America First agenda. Macron's response? By saying our interests matter and never mind the others, he said, you erase that which is most precious for a nation, its moral values. Angela Merkel also warned against the rising tide of nationalism. Peace, she said, should not be taken for granted. Here's another bit of World War I history we wanted to note on the centennial. The so-called Senegalese sharpshooters, or tirailleurs sénégalais.
Tirailleurs Sénégalais were soldiers from essentially what were the French colonies. They were also part of what was called the Armée Noire, the Black Army. They participated in a lot of the battles. There were about 130,000 of these Tirailleurs Sénégalais.
Florence Villeminot is with the France 24 Network and has been reporting on this bit of history. She told me these soldiers came not just from Senegal, but also from other former French colonies like Mali and Ivory Coast, and that many of them were forced to fight under the French flag during World War I.
We often say that the Tirailleurs Sénégalais are the forgotten ones, because when the colonies became independent and when the force was dissolved in the 1960s, France actually froze their pensions, and they were no longer considered veterans like other veterans. And it was only in 2006, so many, many years later, that they were once again considered veterans and started getting their pensions back again.
So what did these fighters actually do during World War I?
Well, they fought in all the big battles in World War I, so Battle of the Somme, Verdun, Chemin des Dames. We often talk about them here in France, though, because they played a really instrumental role in protecting the city of Reims, so Reims in English.
Yeah, where Champagne is from.
Absolutely, and they played an instrumental role in protecting the city from German troops, and many of them died protecting the city. And so there's a monument that's right near the city of Reims that pays tribute to the Tirailleurs Sénégalais, and it's a monument that's actually a couple years old. I believe it's from 2013, but it was only just inaugurated by the president, Emmanuel Macron, so it seems like France is trying to make amends and recognize the role that they played.
It's interesting, though, because as you said earlier, Florence, I mean, the Senegalese tirailleurs are the forgotten ones. So, I mean, why did it take so long for this statue, this commemoration to happen for so many troops from the former colonies, Senegal and Mali, as you say, to be recognized?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with France's complicated history with its colonies. I think for a long time, it just didn't want to recognize, you know, the role that those soldiers had played. We talked about, you know, French soldiers, but they weren't considered French, even though at the time they were part of France. So I think France had to come to terms with its own history. Also, I think France was probably ashamed of a lot of the racism that was involved as well. There was kind of a racist connotation with the Tirailleurs Sénégalais, and I think that was something that France probably just didn't want to look at straight in the face. But, recently France has been recognizing some you know, we're starting to recognize some of its more controversial chapters of history, whether it's with the Tirailleurs Sénégalais or also with the Harkis, so Algerian soldiers that fought alongside France during the Algerian War of Independence. So progress is being made in terms of recognizing the roles that a lot of these key players played in French history.
How much is that part of history, the Tirailleurs Sénégalais, and all of this is taught in French schools?
You know, when I was in school, I don't think we learned that much about it. We spent a lot of time on World War I and World War II. It's typically something you learn about in middle school. It's kind of like the last 2 years of middle school. You'll spend 1 year on World War I and then 1 year on World War II. And you learn about it a little bit. That being said, I haven't been a student in a while. I get the impression that these days they're trying to bring these topics up in schools. People that I've been able to talk to, whether it's teachers or people who go into French schools, their main goal is just to teach children that World War I happened, because, you know, it happened 100 years ago.
So the World War I anniversaries began more than 4 years ago when World War I started. And the network you work for, France 24, has been doing a series of stories during this time to mark the centenary. Now we're at the end of World War I. You've done stories about the Senegalese fighters. I'm just curious, how many personal stories have you and your colleagues encountered during your research, stuff that you've learned about your own families and what they did during World War I?
Well, one story that I've found particularly fascinating that we've been reporting on at France 24 as well is the story of what are called the broken faces, the gueule cassée, which I don't know if you're familiar with this, but it's essentially people who were disfigured, fighters who were disfigured during the war. And they weren't actually considered veterans like other veterans immediately after the war. They didn't get financial help or anything like that. And so they had to band together and they formed an association.
And the gueule cassée, I mean, weren't they walking around wearing masks to hide just the disfigurement?
They sure were. In fact, since they were considered valid for, you know, manual labor, so they had to go out and try to get jobs, but a lot of them couldn't get hired because people were so scared of them and they didn't want to hire someone who had a disfigured face. And so many of them went to wear masks. And there's a story, I believe it was an American sculptor actually who was in Paris, and she made masks for measure for these disfigured soldiers using photos of them from before. And she helped them kind of get their original face back. I guess it was the precursor to plastic surgery, and she helped them have a normal life again.
Florence Villeminot with France 24, thanks for telling us about what you found doing this research on World War I. Really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much for calling.
I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on the world, winter is coming, and a lot of us are making plans to shield ourselves from the elements. But way up north, it's a different story.
Our lives depend on the ice, the cold, and the snow.
Reckoning with an Arctic that's becoming a lot less cold. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We began today looking at the wildfires in California and how that's part of the new normal or abnormal all over the globe. If it seems we're stepping back from other news more and more to look at disasters in nature, you're right, because this is both breaking news right now and a big long-term story about our planet. Today, we're taking on a corner of the planet that we rarely visit, the Arctic, and the ways that climate change is transforming that region, something we've been doing every Monday the past few weeks. Amy Martin has been our guide for these journeys. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Marco.
So you're the host and creator of the Threshold podcast, and this season the podcast is all about the Arctic, and we've been bringing some of your stories, your team stories, to the world. What I've been really appreciating, Amy, is the way you're taking on this massive subject through a few personal stories.
Yeah, I feel like with something as huge as the Arctic and as huge as climate change, it really makes sense to just start really small and get to know individual people and their own personal experiences as kind of a window into the bigger topics.
Yeah, it is a massive topic, also an ominous topic. I remember, though, your comment in one of your stories a couple of weeks ago, who knew that reporting on climate change could be so much fun? where'd you find the fun?
You know, that was one of the things that was really interesting about reporting this season of our show, is that it actually was mostly fun. And I think it's just because the Arctic is this beautiful region and it's full of really interesting people. So often I was just having a really good time out exploring and having these really in-depth, fascinating conversations, even though the content of what I was learning was often very sobering. So yeah, I mean, I had fun almost everywhere. I almost started to feel guilty about it, like it shouldn't be so much fun to be doing this.
Yeah, and by the way, if you missed any of Amy's previous stories, you can find them at theworld.org/thebigmelt. Amy, you've touched down so far in Iceland, Sweden, Norway, and Alaska. And today you're taking us back to northern Alaska for a story about sea ice. As an outsider, Amy, what for you was kind of like the big snapshot after you saw how these communities are experiencing and being affected by climate change?
Well, one thing is that climate change has been affecting people's lives on the North Slope of Alaska for decades. It's not a new story there at all. It's impacting everything. It's impacting how people hunt. It's impacting how they store their food. It's impacting their future as a community. And that people are just really trying their best to adapt. You know, there's determination to make life work with all of these changes.
Amy Martin, host and producer of the Threshold podcast. Thanks.
Thank you.
And let's check out your story now from northern Alaska.
David Levitt has spent a lifetime watching ice.
Long time ago, that good ice all the time. Really not good ice anymore. Yeah, ice in, it's not good anymore.
David is 88, and he lives in Utqiagvik, Alaska. It's the northernmost city in the U.S. on the Arctic Ocean. He grew up in this region, hunting with his family and living a semi-nomadic life. He's Inupiat, one of the indigenous groups of the North American Arctic, and sea ice is a big part of Inupiat life. When he was a child, David says, the ocean would freeze in October, but now sometimes it's not even frozen in December. The ice lasted longer back then, too. David says it often wouldn't melt until July. His eyes light up as he remembers taking the dog sled to summer celebrations in Utqiagvik.
Come up here with the dog team on July. Come up here for the 4th of July with the dog team. No, not anymore. You know that ice is not good anymore.
It's not good anymore because the earth is warming up fast, and it's warming fastest here in the Arctic. This community has been watching that happen for decades.
It was a gradual change, and then it accelerated.
This is Gordon Brower. He also lives in Utqiagvik. And like David, he remembers when it was normal for the sea ice to stick around well into the summer and build up from year to year.
In the 70s, you had multi-year ice all the way up to maybe 1980s. And to me, that's a vivid memory because that's when I was very active as a young person. And then from the 80s to the 90s, another era of change in the ice, and then from the 90s to today, a much more accelerated pace because the retreat is so extensive. You would see probably retreats in the 70s maybe 15, 20 miles, but today you're looking at retreat of ice for hundreds of miles.
Gordon remembers this so clearly because he spent a lot of time living on the ice, learning how to hunt whales.
And I know it's not a very big thing to talk about downstate, about catching whales and killing them, but we have been doing that for thousands of years to survive. That's the only way we could have survived here.
Whales have always been a crucial food source in this harsh and isolated environment. And even today, food that's shipped into grocery stores can be wildly expensive. So the ability to hunt really matters here. That's why indigenous communities in Utqiagvik and across the Arctic fought hard for the right to keep their subsistence whale hunt when most commercial whaling was banned a few decades ago. Gordon says they use every part of the whale, and they share the food throughout the community. To be part of a crew providing this food was and is a major source of pride.
The whale brings on a festival of its own, and everybody gets new garments and clothing, and sometimes people get married and other things happen. And it feels good because a whale means so much. Because there's the widows, there's the ill, there's the children, there's the ability to make food manageable for a large community. It makes me feel good that I'm doing a service for my community.
The whales hunted here are mostly bowheads, which can grow up to 60 feet long and weigh 100 tons. Gordon learned how to hunt whales as a child, and he says a big part of that education involved learning about sea ice.
Our camps were sometimes 15 miles out offshore. We would live offshore for up to a month trying to harvest these marine mammals.
They'd bring food and shelter, but they didn't need to bring fresh water because they could get that from the ice itself. As sea ice gets older, it squeezes the salt out. So if you have ice that's 5 or 10 years old, you can melt it and drink it.
You don't see that anymore, and now you got to bring your own water from shore to your camp offshore because you're not seeing these glaciated type ice that develop over long periods of time that are salt-free.
And that's not the only change out on the ice.
It's considerably, I think, more dangerous. It's not as, you're not as sure-footed on the ice anymore.
In many communities up here, more people are falling through the ice now when they're whaling or traveling, especially on snowmobiles. Loss of sea ice affects all kinds of animals, too. There are the polar bears, of course, but also narwhals, walruses, seals, even birds. They're all being affected as the sea ice recedes. And people much farther away are watching.
The health of the ice cover is not very good.
This is Mark Serez, the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado.
Since the dawn of the modern satellite record, 1979, it's decreasing in all months. In September especially, September is the end of the melt season in the Arctic, and that's when the biggest trends have been occurring, something like 13% per decade. It's tremendous.
Sea ice grows in the winter when the Arctic is very cold and dark, and then dies back every summer. But for all of human history, there's always been some Arctic sea ice that doesn't melt in the summer. That's the thick multi-year ice that Gordon Brower talked about. And like Gordon, Mark says there's much less of it now.
Basically, it's getting so warm now that it's hard to form all this really old, thick, multi-year ice. And some of that old, thick, multi-year ice just melts away, but we really can't regenerate it anymore.
So the sea ice is getting both thinner and covering a smaller area. And that's a really big deal, because one of the most important things polar ice does for all of us is reflect sunlight and heat back into space. Scientists call this albedo. It's how reflective something is. Sea ice in the Arctic has always been a giant reflective shield, bouncing heat away from the planet.
Well, if we think about what sea ice is, it's one of the higher albedo surfaces of our planet.
But as sea ice starts to melt, the Arctic reflects less solar energy and absorbs more of it, which leads to a scary feedback loop. Less sea ice means more of the Arctic is mostly dark ocean. That absorbs more heat, which leads to more ice loss, etc. This is one of the reasons why the Arctic is warming up so fast. And there's more to the story of what's changing as Arctic sea ice disappears. The ice helps keep the Arctic cold, and the difference between the cold Arctic and the warmer temperate zones is part of what drives weather systems around the Northern Hemisphere. As the Arctic warms, some scientists think it's knocking those weather systems out of whack. We've still got a lot to learn about all of these processes and other impacts of sea ice loss, but there's one bottom line. Arctic sea ice has helped keep the Earth's climate running in a more or less predictable way for thousands of years. And as we warm up the planet, we're making it harder for the ice to do that work for us.
Our lives depend on the ice, the cold, and the snow.
This is Sheila Watt-Cloutier. She's the former head of the International Inuit Circumpolar Council, which advocates for Inuit people across the North. She's talking about Arctic people, but she could be talking about all of us. It's just that the people who live here see it and experience it way more directly.
And many of our elders have been saying, we are teaching you the traditional knowledge that we have been taught over millennia about safety, about the conditions of what is out there on that ice and snow. But they say there's a disclaimer now as a result of climate change, where many of our elders have said, this is what I'm teaching you. However, and that's the disclaimer here, the rules are changing.
Sheila's from eastern Canada, thousands of miles from Utqiagvik, but she says the changes in the Arctic affect all of the 150,000 Inuit people who live here, from eastern Russia all the way over to Greenland.
It isn't just the ice and the polar bear that we would be losing, but all of the wisdom would go with that ice as well. And that's the fear that we have, is that our culture is so connected to everything that is around us, including the ice. And the ice, of course, is our life force. And as that starts to go, it minimizes our ability to live as Inuit as we've known it for millennia.
I'm back in Utqiagvik watching a performance of traditional Inupiaq dancing and drumming. The movements are all about hunting. They mimic the paddling of the skin boats on the waves and the careful leaps from one ice floe to another. And they evoke the tight bond in this hunting culture between the hunters and the animals. But even as they've continued their subsistence hunting, the people in Utqiagvik have also become part of the cash economy. They need whales, but they also need textbooks and computers. And in this part of Alaska, a lot of that cash comes from just one source.
We don't have any other horse to ride up here. The Arctic is an oil and gas province.
That's Gordon Brower again. 50 years ago, one of the largest oil fields in North America was discovered east of here in Prudhoe Bay. Gordon says local people knew that would mean big changes here, so they worked to forge agreements that would help preserve their culture while using the income from fossil fuel development to fund schools, hospitals, roads, and more.
We needed to do something so we were not completely overtaken and assimilated, but to find a way to balance and coexist.
Since then, natural gas and coal have also been found in the region. The money earned from taking all of that stuff out of the ground has transformed life up here, but it's come at a cost, because those are the same fossil fuels that are causing the climate to warm up and the ice to melt away.
If you're thinking about, am I contradicting myself in trying to balance oil and gas development with what's going on today with the ice extent retreat, the permafrost issues that we're having, I don't know, but I know we're going to adapt, and we still got to preserve the whale and do our best to preserve it and feed people.
The dilemma that Utqiagvik is in is the same one we're all facing. We're all drinking from the same oil well, even as it slowly disrupts everything around us. I traveled around the Arctic on planes that run on fossil fuel, and I'm recording this in a studio heated by them. The electricity that runs the device you're listening to right now was probably also made by burning fossil fuel. Oil, gas, and coal are woven into the fabric of our lives, but the pollution from those fuels threatens all of us. Some of that damage is already baked in, but we know enough to be able to limit it, around the globe and here in the Arctic. The first step, says Mark Serez, is facing facts.
We understand the basic science here. We have got this nailed down. Climate change is real, and it is us.
For The World, I'm Amy Martin, Utqiagvik, Alaska.
Amy had reporting help from Nick Mott. Her stories about climate change in the Arctic come through our partnership with the Threshold podcast and radio program, with funding support from the Pulitzer Center. You can check out all the stories at theworld.org/thebigmelt. You can also find the whole season of the Threshold podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. On this Veterans Day holiday, it's worth remembering that about 8% of all living Americans have served in the military at some point in their lives. Veterans, of course, all have their own stories about why they served. Here's one from Nate Terani. He served in an elite unit in the U.S. Navy. The World's Monica Campbell has his story.
Nate Terani was a child, 8 years old, when he was at school and started hearing gunfire.
These religious police soldiers stormed into the school, essentially grabbed us by the scruff of the neck, and threw us all into this round courtyard.
It was Tehran, 1985.
Right in the middle of the Iran-Iraq war, right in sort of some of the most difficult and bloody period of that war. But when we went, there was a temporary ceasefire. And there was a thought at the time, I believe, that the war wasn't going to resume.
Normally, Nate lived in New Jersey with his parents, who were born in Iran. But that year, His family went to Tehran to spend a few months with relatives. So that morning, Nate was at a bilingual international school, flags from different countries in the hallways, France, the U.S. Nate says it was a target for extremists.
And they took all the flags that were in the hallways, and the American flag in particular, set them on fire and sent those flags burning into the courtyard and demanded that the kids who were there chant Maragbar Amrika, which is death to America, and stomp on the burning flag. I was filled with what I would describe as real righteous indignation. I think because of that sense of I'm an American and I have something that I need to stand up for here and now. And even at 8 years old, I refused. I refused to chant death to America and I refused to stomp on the flag.
Nate and his family returned to the U.S. And Nate says that experience seeded his desire to join the U.S. military.
I knew that I wanted to join the military. I knew I wanted to wear the American flag on my arm. At that young age, I knew it. I was in Cub Scouts, and I was so filled with pride to wear that Cub Scout uniform.
He enlisted in 1997, during his first year in college, and eventually he joined the U.S. Navy Presidential Ceremonial Honor Guard, assigned to funerals at Arlington National Cemetery or the White House, a prestigious unit, and Nate was told he was one of the team's first Muslims.
They appreciated the fact that they had an Iranian-American, a Muslim-American, as a part of this unit. The images that we see are the opposite. The images that we see are of this sort of ambiguous hooded villain in the desert somewhere that's out to get you. The truth of the matter is that American Muslims have served in every war since the American Revolution that this country has ever fought.
In 2006, Nate left the military. He says his family needed help with his ailing grandfather. He's 41 now and back in school, getting a degree in psychology. He lives in Tucson, Arizona, near the U.S.-Mexico border, where troops are deployed now, responding to a group of Central American migrants heading north that President Trump calls a foreign invasion. I asked Nate if he'd enlist again now. He said he would. But it gets more complicated when I ask, what if it meant being deployed to the border?
That's a really hard question. I'm not in that position now, and I'm not on active duty or in the military. And I don't know if I can answer that. You know, if we're talking about asylum seekers and refugees and immigrants in this country, the message that we should be sending is that you are who built this country. And if we turn our backs on that sacred ideal, then we betray everything that those people in the military are serving.
As a vet, he's also committed to raising awareness about Muslims in the military. He was part of a veterans group that met with American Muslim communities in 2016, sat with them as they broke their fast during Ramadan. He protested against the Trump administration's travel ban in 2017.
My mom immigrated to the United States from Iran when she was a little girl. She loves this country.
This Muslim ban betrays the very values that American veterans served and sacrificed to uphold.
It's fundamentally important that either Muslims or immigrants from any other group don't feel that they are alienated or isolated right now because of the rhetoric that is coming from certain politicians. That rhetoric has to do with them, and it has to do with fear baiting. We are so much greater than one politician's fear baiting. We are so much greater than hate.
Nate says his activism is an extension of his service, an extension, he says, of protecting the U.S. flag from being trampled on like when he was a kid in Iran. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
Nate Tarani, by the way, is featured in a new documentary called Loyalty Stories. Finally today, we say goodbye to a couple of pop culture superheroes, two artists who have definitely left an indelible mark on many of us. One of them is Stan Lee, the creator of Spider-Man, The Incredible Hulk, Black Panther, many other comic book heroes. Stan Lee died today. The other artist I want to honor is Douglas Rain, a towering figure in pop culture, at least for me, because I'm a major fan. Rain passed away this weekend. Classically trained, a Shakespearean most of his life, in fact performed for 32 seasons at the Stratford Festival in Ontario. But he will be remembered most of all for this.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Douglas Rain gave voice to the HAL 9000 computer, the force of evil, in Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. Rain's flat, appropriately robotic delivery worked brilliantly, and that fateful scene in 2001 where Dave finally disconnects HAL, you listen back to that now and it plays like the end of a dysfunctional relationship, which it was.
I know I've made some very poor decisions recently, but I can give you my complete assurance that my work will be back to normal.
Douglas Rain, the actor behind that voice, was 90 when he died at a hospital in Ontario.
I am a HAL 9000 computer.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
And he taught me to sing a song. If you'd like to hear it, I can sing it for you. Daisy.
PRI, Public Radio International.